Have you ever been turned off with Jesus? If so, why? Is it because of the way you experienced Jesus through people who said they followed him? Maybe you experienced judgment, narrowness, or an idea that being associated with Jesus meant you had to be a less critical thinker or self-righteous. Or maybe that you had to believe things that are just difficult for you to believe. Have you ever been turned off with Jesus? If anyone's ever had a good right to be turned off with Jesus, it's the woman in our story today. She's not introduced to us by name, just by a label, a Canaanite. You can typically tell what we think of others when we identify them with labels. Well, she's an Iowa fan. Who might be saying that today? He's just a Southerner. Well, that person's an immigrant. Well, Canaanite was definitely a derogatory term used in Matthew's gospel. If you were identifying the person by her race because she lived in the region of Tyre and Sidon, you would have called her a Syrophoenician, like the Gospel of Mark does. Matthew instead dredges up the old racial identity from the Old Testament, Canaanite, Israel's loathed, hated enemy, the people who worship the god Baal, the worship that involved sexual fertility rites and child sacrifice. Matthew intends for us, by the label, to think of her in a derogatory manner before we even know anything about her. Now, what was Jesus doing in her neck of the woods? He was there escaping tension he created himself with the religious leadership in his homeland. He had called the Pharisees a bunch of hypocrites and blind guides. He was criticizing them for the way they had let their emphasis on religious rules get in the way of forming a loving heart that translates into loving behavior toward other people. He critiqued them for all kinds of behaviors he had a problem with the Pharisees. Listen to some of these. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, theft, slander, and insults. Now, we're going to come back to those last two words in just a moment, slander and insults. But this is what Jesus has said right before going to Tyre and Sidon. And he no more than arrives in this different land than this Canaanite woman comes up to him and says, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly." Interesting title she uses for Jesus. I pointed out last week that in the first half of the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, called synoptic Gospels, because the word synoptic means seen alongside of, they all tell the story of Jesus in a similar chronological fashion. The first half of the story is this story of growing faith in the disciples. They begin by calling Jesus teacher, and then they eventually get to the place where they call him Lord, and eventually, they will say, "We believe you're the Son of God." Now, they haven't gotten here yet, but they've made progress since last week. They had a big week this week, the disciples did. They went from calling him teacher, now they're calling him Lord. They're just not quite all the way. And here comes this woman, a Canaanite, who uses a Jewish messianic title for Jesus, Lord, Son of David. She recognizes his identity before the disciples do. She's the first person in the Gospels to make a profession of faith in Jesus as the Christ. But with her request for her daughter, Jesus has nothing to say. He gives her the silent treatment. The disciples want to send her away. Ever notice how many times the disciples were quick to get rid of people? "Jesus, get the children out of here. They're a nuisance." These hungry people, Lord, send them home so they can get something to eat. This Canaanite woman, send her away. There's still room to grow in their faith. But Jesus doesn't send her away. He addresses her. He says, well, what does he say? Now, I'm confused. Jesus addresses her by telling her that he did not come for people like her. He came for the lost sheep of Israel. That is why he has come. He's come for the other people, not her. Now, chances are that this is exactly what Jesus believed his mission was. His mission was not to all people. It was to be restricted to those within the boundaries of Israel. In fact, just a few chapters earlier in Matthew's gospel, when Jesus sends the disciples out on their first mission, look at what he says to them. Stay away from the Gentiles and don't go to any Samaritan town. Go only to the people of Israel because they are like a flock of lost sheep. So Jesus is saying to this woman, you don't have a place in my mission. But she doesn't give in. She gets on her knees before Jesus and says, Lord, please help me. Talk about a demonstration of faith in the Bible. She not only declares an intellectual belief in who Jesus is, now she's on her knees praying, Lord, please help me. Have you ever prayed a prayer like that before? Have you ever had an experience in your life where something drove you to your knees before Jesus, and in desperation you said, Lord, please help me? And this is where we come back to those words, slander and insults. The very thing Jesus criticized in the behavior of his own religious leadership. Think about that now as you hear what Jesus says to her next. It's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. But this woman will still not give up. She comes right back at Jesus. Yes, Lord. Now, I want to just ask you, if Jesus had just called you a dog, would you still call him Lord? But she says, yes, Lord. But even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. And at that, Jesus says, your faith is great. Your request is answered. There's no getting away from the offense in this passage. Jesus calls her a dog. He refers to her in the racial derogatory tone that people throughout his upbringing would have said about people like this woman. He calls her a dog. Now, interpreters of scripture have tried to soften the offense through the years. In fact, some of them have said, they point out that the word in Greek, New Testament was written in Greek, the word in Greek that Jesus uses for dogs is a less diminutive word. He's not talking about the wild dogs that roam the streets and will bite you. He's talking about a household pet like Roscoe, your sheepdog. Now, if Jesus called you a dog, don't you feel better now? He's talking about Fido at home. Oh, okay, well then that's all right. Oh, come on. Some say, when you have the words that are spoken in the Bible, that's one thing. What you miss is the tone, the inflection, the gestures that are made. Some scholars say what was probably going on here was Jesus gave the woman a little wink. Like, I know that there are a lot of my kind of people who talk to people like you and say, it's not right to take the children's food and give it to the dogs. Wink, wink, nod, nod. That's not me, of course. Oh, come on. Jesus is offensive. There's no escaping it. There's no getting around it. I preached on this story last August, and I don't typically go back to the same story so close together in a period of time. But I spent more time in that sermon talking about how we understand the offense of Jesus in this story, and that perhaps it reflects Jesus' own upbringing and Jesus' own understanding about his mission up to this point, that it was for just Israelites, but this woman changed it for him that day. She changed it. She gave Jesus a new reason to reflect on his mission, and it left him a different person thinking, maybe it's not just for a few. Maybe it's for everybody. Now, some people, they have a problem with this idea. They say, no, wait a minute. Jesus is fully divine. This woman didn't come and straighten Jesus out. Jesus knew what he was supposed to be doing all along. If he said it was only for the few people, and he had a reason for saying that. We just need to understand it. I think it's okay that Jesus might not have had it all figured out. I think it's okay. Because it reflects a faith that's growing and that can get challenged and allows oneself to think about, what is it I really believe? This is going to make me think now. What this person has said, what happened here? I've got to go think about this. That's a great statement of faith to me. I believe Jesus was also fully human. And he's showing us a faith that looks a lot like ours. But. This story is not about Jesus' faith. It's about the woman's. And because of her retort to Jesus, he says she has great faith. Why is that? What is great about her faith? I want to think about that for a few moments. And I want to make a few observations about her actions in this story that might be getting at Jesus' point about what is the essence of great faith. For one thing, she didn't let silence deter her. She didn't let silence deter her. She came to Jesus with a request and she got nothing. Have you ever experienced that in prayer? Have you ever come to God with a need and you make your request known but you don't get an answer? You just get silence. It can be so off-putting. But this woman doesn't give up, even in the silence. She goes to her knees and she says, please, Lord, help me. There's a picture of greatness in this. That just because she's experiencing silence, she's not giving up. Because in this demonstration, her faith is not something she possesses, it's something she expresses. Let me try to describe what I mean by that. When Jesus makes statements like great faith or little faith, it's easy to think of faith in some quantifiable fashion, as if there's an amount of faith that you can have, and the more amount of faith you have, the stronger you're going to be, kind of like building up muscle. If you go to the gym and you work out, you lift weights, your muscles get stronger. You can see it. If you never do any strength conditioning, you don't see it, and you're weaker. And sometimes we think faith is like that. That the more faith you have, the stronger it makes you, and the more control and power you have on the conditions around you. And faith is just the opposite. Faith is the admission that we don't control anything, that we are dependent creatures, and we are weak, and we need God's help. In fact, faith recognizes that God has probably been helping us throughout our lives more than we ever realized it. Faith in this picture is this utter, raw, determined reliance upon God that doesn't give up, that even in silence continues to knock on the door and to beg and to plead until something happens. The great slave emancipator, Harriet Tubman, had a simple prayer that she prayed. Lord, I'm going to hold steady onto you, and you've got to see me through. That's great faith. But let's go back to the woman in our story. Consider another observation. She didn't let discouragement dissuade her. She didn't let discouragement dissuade her. When Jesus said, "I came only for the lost sheep of Israel, not you," she didn't give up. Now, think about the power of that. We're not talking about silence now. We're talking about a flat-out no. Silence is better. With silence, you've at least got a possible maybe. You don't have a no when there's silence. But when you get a flat-out no, but this woman, she's persistent as crabgrass. She will not go away. And she keeps digging and pestering and praying. Now, let's be honest. Let's be honest here. What's the source of her faith? The source of her faith is not a belief in Jesus. It's pure desperation. It's desperation. Her daughter is suffering. That's why she went to Jesus. Really, if you think about it, why did she go to Jesus? She's never met him before. He has never been in her region. She would have never witnessed for herself a miracle performed by Jesus. All she has to go on is a hope that maybe he can help her. It's a desperation that drives her before Jesus. Sometimes faith looks that way. I mean, there's nothing pretty about it. Faith can be downright ugly when you practice it, when you don't think of it as something that you possess, but you express it. You're expressing this utter desperation. God, I'm not even sure you can do anything about my need, but I've got nowhere else to go. I just got this little ounce of hope in my soul. Please, please, please. It's begging. Sometimes faith comes to that. Sometimes faith looks like kneeling at the altar and digging your fingernails into the rail and saying, "I'm not going to leave here until I get an answer." That's great faith. That is a faith that refuses to be dissuaded. There's a volunteer in our church who has great-grandchildren who live several states away. And she's very worried about them. She's concerned about the care that they're receiving, about the attention that they're getting, about the environment they're living in. And she's so desperate to get custody of her great-grandchildren so that they can come and live with her and let her take care of them. And you can imagine all of this is within her family. It's difficult. It's hard. It's painful. But when you talk with her about her faith, every time I see her, she says, "I know God's in this. God's got a hand on this. I'm trusting in God. I'm trusting in God." You know, some people, when they don't see their prayer answered, it's a reason to sort of get weak in faith. But I know it works the other way too. It works the other way. When the need is that much more important, it drives you in your faith. Because you say, "I've got nowhere else to turn. I've got to have God's help in this." Have you ever had that kind of experience in your life? request is granted. Think of the woman in a figurative way for a moment. Have you ever been diminished in your life? Have you ever been diminished by life? Have you ever been diminished by circumstances you face that it just feels like the pressure and the force of the situation just wears you down? Have you been diminished by the treatment of other people that would make you believe you are less of a person than you are? Have you ever been diminished by life? What does it look like to hang on to God? I like the Message translation of 2 Corinthians chapter 4. We've been surrounded and battered by troubles, but we're not demoralized. We're not sure what to do, but we know that God knows what to do. We've been spiritually terrorized, but God hasn't left our side. We've been thrown down, but we haven't broken. What they did to Jesus, they do to us. Trial and torture, mockery and murder. What Jesus did among them, he does in us. He lives. He lives. A couple of weeks ago, Susan and I went to see our daughter in California and her husband, and they waited until we got there to tell us that they're expecting their first child. So for us, we're going to be first-time grandparents. I even took a little picture of the ultrasound. You want to see it? Show it to him. That's the heartbeat. That's my grandchild. Thanks. What's really interesting is to be having that experience with that daughter. Because some years ago, Susan and I really, we didn't know if we would have that kind of experience one day. When she was 14, I was reassigned by the bishop to a new church. And the church we left was the only one our daughters had ever known as home. Their only friendships in life had been in that community. And she was really upset. It was a hard move. I realized adolescence and anger are a really bad combination. And she got angry. She took out the anger on us. She, I'm sure, took it out on the church, took it out on God. It was some rough years. It was during that time I was just at a very low point one day. I went to see a pastor friend of mine who was in a nearby town, and he was a little more than a decade older than me. His children were grown. He said, "Rob, let me tell you about my daughter. She went through a really, really rough adolescence. She just got super wild. We would go to counseling together. I remember one time we were with the counselor, and the counselor in the middle of the session leaned over, looked at me, said, 'Dad, you're just going to have to let go.' He said, I got so mad. I wanted to say back to that counselor, 'What do you think we're doing here? We are here to come up with a new contract with new terms of agreement about how she's to behave.'" But he had to let go. Not many weeks after that infamous counseling session, it was the Saturday night before Easter, and the daughter came home about 2 a.m, inebriated. They got up, they had their usual argument. The daughter slammed her door, went to bed. He said, "Rob, I was standing in the shower at 3 a.m, with Easter services not that many hours away, just empty. And I prayed in the shower, 'God, I've got nothing to say today. I have no faith to tell your people about. I need a sermon.'" He said, "As you know, sometimes it just comes to that for pastors. There are just times you go, 'I don't know if I've got anything to say, Lord.' He said, "But you get up and you say it anyway." And I did. I talked about an Easter faith I did not feel, and did not totally believe in the moment. But things started getting better. Less arguing. I was practicing letting go. My daughter started practicing better decision making. Now let me fast forward a couple of years. I had a funeral for a child in the church. In fact, it hadn't been long before this conversation. He said it was just one of those tough funerals of a child, a well-known family. It's just hard. He said after the funeral, I was walking back to my study to hang my robe up, and my daughter was standing there. He said, "What are you doing here?" She said, "I came to the funeral." He said, I didn't know that you knew this family." She said, "I don't. I knew it would be hard for you, Daddy. I wanted to be here for you." And they hugged and embraced. He said, "Faith sometimes means believing in spite of your own unbelief." He said, "I understand better now than I ever did the man in the Gospels when Jesus asked him, 'Do you believe?' And he said, 'I believe. Help my unbelief.'" Sometimes faith means trusting in God to do what we don't think is possible. Because what's the alternative?